the propaganda from, because they're playing like InfoWars and talking about demonic baby pedophile, all this stuff is just infuriating. And I don't know the solution to it because it's just making people stronger in their beliefs that are just untrue.
It's lunacy. It's lunacy. Well, listen,
And
good
then I
luck
had
there in
one quick
Oklahoma
one.
because it's getting pretty grim. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right, Casey, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right. There's Casey from Oklahoma, the site of a horrifying, horrifying, horrifying abortion bill. Let's go to Tristan from Boston. Tristan, you're on the air.
Hey, David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Cool. It occurred to me recently, have you considered writing a book?
Yes, in fact, I'm working on a proposal right now. It's a big project. It's a long process, but I am working on that right now.
Wow, that's actually pretty cool. If you don't mind me asking, what is the subject?
I don't want to say because we're still workshopping it, and then I might end up kind of self-cucking. I don't want to do that.
Does that include elements of many subjects?
It
I
actually
would
does.
imagine.
It actually does. Yeah. It's a multidisciplinary proposal.
I mean, that would feel like the main topics, the ideas for the main topics would be pretty obvious.
Well, we'll find out,
Cons
won't we, Tristan?
considering your fields of expertise.
Sure. Yeah, no, when I have more to say about it, I absolutely will, but it's something I am working on.
That's actually great to hear. I would 100%. I'm totally pumped to hear that.
Well, good. It
Can't
sounds like
wait.
at least I'd sell one copy.
Can't wait to see it,
All
Dave.
right. Tristan, thank you so much.
Awesome.
All right. There's Tristan from Boston asking about a book project. Thanks to everybody who called in. My apologies to everybody I couldn't get to. We'll take calls again. And for now, we will take a very quick break and be right back. All right, let's review this week's mailbag. If you have a message for me, you can email it to info@davidpakman.com. Many, many messages come in every week. I think probably 1,000 or so. And we can only look at, 10 or so. So just understand that. Please be polite. Please be respectful. info@davidpakman.com. All right, first email this week came in from Christopher, who also signed his email Keith. I don't know. Christopher says, after this weekend's Trump rally, you talk crap about Trump. How much is your gas now compared to when Trump was in office? Well, I drive an electric car, so my gas hasn't changed, but I understand the point. How about your grocery bill? Yes, it's higher. But what does Joe Biden have to do with that? How about everything you buy bring way up with the Democratic leadership? Don't understand why you dummies can't look at numbers instead of your personal political opinion. F Biden and F you. Well, that's exactly what I do. Regardless of my political opinion, which is I prefer Biden to Trump, I have to look at the numbers when it comes to gas prices, inflation, etc. And when I look at the numbers, I see that those things are up all over the world. And I see that those are not phenomena that depend on the American president to any significant degree. I'm not going to do, I respect you too much in the audience to do my what can presidents do about gas prices rant a second, third, what it must be probably the fifth time now. So I'm not going to do that. But it is exactly because I do look at the facts that I come to the conclusions I come to. And Christopher or Keith, I don't know, is welcome to call into my show anytime, and we can talk about it. Next, Gil wrote in, also about the Trump rally over the weekend, and said, "You seem to laugh at Donald Trump. I think you don't know very much. USA is a corporation. USA Inc. since yesterday. USA become a republic like if was before." And one more thing, Donald know more than you about political rules in Michigan. Well, I couldn't possibly say it any better myself. And this is just such a wholesale destruction of my ideology and worldview that I won't even try to respond to Giel because it's just too much. It's just overwhelming. Okay, next email is from Darius. Darius says, new subscriber here, you killed Air with Darlene. David, I stumbled on your YouTube videos a couple of years ago and have been evangelizing you to my friends and finally decided it's time to pay for solid journalism. So I am now a subscriber supporting the work you do. I love it. Just remember, I do commentary, not journalism. Important distinction. Darius goes on to say, however, your interview with Diana Swafford, it was Darlene Swafar. Okay, but it doesn't matter. I know who you mean. Put you in the category of why doesn't this guy have his own MSNBC or CNN show? Your interview, oh boy, was absolutely brilliant. You were respectful, even complimentary. Your poker face was amazing and critical to keep her from walking off. You parsed the oil issue brilliantly. Dude, you need an agent to up your game and get a broadcast cable show. This country needs people like you. Please try to do more interviews like these. Well, I really appreciate that. I have an agent. We are not trying to get me on MSNBC or CNN or Fox or whatever. I'm very happy with what I'm doing. I don't want to have 10 bosses at any of those places. I don't think they want me there either. But I so appreciate the kind words from Darius about this. And we are trying to get more of those interviews lined up with the 2020 candidates on the right and on the left. We're doing it all. We're doing it all. Next, let's go to an email from Teresa. Teresa said, is there a way I can gift more than one membership at a time? David said on air that there were over 600 hoping to become members. I'd like to offer several gifts anonymously. Thank you. Yeah, so Teresa is asking a perfect question. One of the biggest things people in the audience wanted was they wanted to be able to gift memberships on our website. They would write in, they would say, sir, I have a membership, but I want to give some memberships away. Can I do that? And up until 2 weeks ago, the answer was no. But we listened. We have a new plugin on our website, joinpacman.com, which when you go through the checkout now, there's a box and it says, is this a gift? And if you check the box, your membership will be added to our queue, which we can give away. We've given away about 100 memberships so far, thanks to gifts. But we do have now, it's not even 600, it's now 670 people waiting for a membership. So we are going to try, Teresa, to make this a possibility where you can just do 10 at a time, 20 at a time, 30, you know, just dump memberships in. We're going to try. But in the meantime, you can still gift individual memberships one at a time. What a generous audience. Beautiful. Spencer wrote in about my use of the term bad faith. Spencer says, hey, David, I've been watching your show for well over a year now and have a request that seems simple, but it may take some time to elaborate on the answer. Could you give a definition or explanation on the phrase bad faith in terms of political questions and comments? I personally haven't had an issue agreeing with you whenever you use it, but it may help others understand why you use that phrase to dismiss certain talking points and ideas from both the right and left. So here's the thing. There's two answers about what we mean by bad faith. The first one is you sort of know bad faith when you see it. And what I mean by that is you might remember when I appeared on the Jesse Lee Peterson show and he asked me, what is love? And I knew that it was a bad faith question to try to wrap me up into some kind of homophobic thing. And so I didn't even take it seriously. I said, you know, oh, Jesse, you know love when you see it. It's sort of ethereal. And I don't know what I said. I just kind of laughed it off. But what we mean by bad faith is that there's an intent to deceive or that you are not being genuine in your intention. So to give an example, when Marsha Blackburn asks Judge, now just soon to be Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, what is a woman? It's not that by definition, asking what a woman is a bad faith question. A five-year-old would ask lots of questions that are just, they don't have the information yet. What is a woman? Okay, great. Or a three-year-old. I don't know when kids ask, what's a woman? What's a man? But the point of the question is deceptive. It's not a mere curiosity. It's a bad faith attempt to get Judge Jackson to pigeonhole herself with one definition, which will then be turned and used against her for political reasons. So with bad faith, you have to understand context. Bad faith is sort of like a dog whistle. The idea of a dog whistle is the same way that if you blow a dog whistle, the dogs hear it, but humans don't, or at least not as loud. Okay. It's the same type of thing with dog whistles, where if you didn't understand, listen, imagine that you're from a society that has not had contact with the West, call it, okay? And I say to you, yeah, you know, oh, I'm trying to think of a good example. If I say to you, yeah, we're going to look into the people that control Hollywood, like George Soros and Steven Spielberg, right? And I list a bunch of Jewish people. Unless you know what to listen for, you don't realize that that's an anti-Semitic trope. And much like with a dog whistle, you have to be conditioned to hear it. You also have to understand context to be able to identify bad faith questions. I hope that I'm being clear. I hope that I'm being clear in this, but an important question for sure. Dave wrote in, and Dave says, about my story on Republican COVID deaths. David, you should have mentioned their base is substantially older than the Democrats. I would bet out of the 73,000 Florida deaths you mentioned, you can add another 20,000 because they are older voters, 60s to 90s. I bet 60% are Republican at least. Great show. Yeah, we just don't have the numbers. The question here is about the partisan death gap in COVID. We know it skews towards Republicans. We just don't know by how much, and we don't know if by enough to make a difference in any midterm elections. But I welcome any information we might have about that. Keith wrote in with an idea. Here's an idea from Keith. David, sir, as your show is an independent operation, I know maintaining a workable revenue stream is an ongoing effort. I have a one-word solution for you. Reruns. Reruns made the creators of shows like Friends and Seinfeld billionaires, or very nearly so. Why not you? Reruns, David, reruns. Well, I appreciate the support, Keith, but there is a difference between the Marble Rye and its replay value as a Seinfeld episode and what was in the news on August 10th of 2012. There's not that much replay value to news shows. So I love the idea. In practice, I don't know if it works, but what does work is we will sometimes weave together themed episodes where we say, let's take the issue of climate and make an episode out of our best interviews about climate change. We've done that and people generally like it. So that works. Just reruns. I just don't know. They're good for a few months, but I don't think anyone's going to buy them. But I appreciate the thinking about how to grow revenue. Last email today is from Doug, who also signs his email Brian. I don't know why people do this. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Doug says, David, please refrain from using the phrase guys or you guys. It's disrespecting the women in your audience. Consider using folks or you folks. Yeah, this is a regional thing. In New England, it's very growing up, you just used guys. It was inclusive of everybody. And I'd never used folks. I never used use. I never used y'all. I certainly don't intend to disrespect any women. But if you agree with Doug or Brian, maybe you agree with Brian and disagree with Doug. I have no idea. This is from Doug/Brian. If you agree, disagree, let me know your thoughts. Is it offensive when I casually say, guys, I don't know if I can take this Republican BS anymore. Am I being disrespectful to women when I say that? Let me know. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to instantly access the bonus show. Also remember that on Tuesday, April 19, 6 p.m. Eastern, we'll be doing the next David Pakman Show viewer town hall. It will be live only on our second YouTube channel, Pakman Live. That's youtube.com/.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So there's a new study which finds that legalizing cannabis, also known as marijuana, pot, weed, etc., legalizing cannabis lowers demand for prescription drugs. And this really shouldn't come as a surprise to us. I mean, if we want to focus in just narrowly on this, we know that sometimes cannabis can be a substitute for pharmaceutical anxiety medication. We can know that cannabis, we know that cannabis is sometimes a workable substitute for big pharma sleep medication. We know that cannabis can be a replacement for opiate pain medication. There's a long list, and it's not the idea that cannabis is this panacea cure-all substance, but we know from good studies that in many cases, you can find a cannabis-based alternative for a variety of different symptoms where you might reach for some other kind of medication. Now, whether we say it's better to reach for the cannabis or not, I'm not even evaluating that in this segment. It actually doesn't matter for our purposes. But the point is, we know that there is this very the tentacles of opposition to cannabis legalization come from a number of different areas. And now we have a new study which points very specifically to this aspect of it. There's a good piece in The Hill about this. Legalizing marijuana lowers demand for prescription drugs, study finds. The reductions in drug utilization that we find could lead to significant cost savings for state Medicaid programs. The results also indicate an opportunity to reduce the harm that can come with the dangerous side effects associated with some prescription drugs, one researcher said. I encourage you to read about the study and the details about the study. But as I pointed out, they found a decline in the volume of prescriptions targeting pain, depression, anxiety, sleep, psychosis, and seizures in states that have legalized recreational use. So what are the kind of important takeaways as we think about this as a political issue? It makes a lot of sense that lots of different elements would want to keep cannabis illegal or at least not recreationally legal. It increases profits in a number of different areas. I'm only going to mention a few. There's probably more. So big pharma, if you have widespread recreational cannabis legalization, big pharma profits would likely go down in those places. Private prisons. We've said before, you know, private prisons are not as big in the United States as some people think. I think the last study I saw says private prison inmates are 9 or 11% of federal inmates and like 0% or close to zero at the state level. I believe that that's true. But to some degree, when you have more reasons why someone might be imprisoned, that's good for private prison profits, for sure. The bail bonds industry. If you take something that's currently against the law and you make it legal, fewer people will demand the service of bail bonds. Lawyers, right? I mean, to some degree, if you eliminate a crime, you eliminate the need for lawyers to defend people against charges for that crime. We also know that cannabis legalization lowers demand for alcohol. I don't know, but I wonder if it reduces the demand for cigarettes. Maybe I don't know enough about the cigarette piece to be able to say for sure. And I'm sure that I'm missing many here in my discussion of this. So this is both why, on the one hand, a lot of these different industries would want to keep cannabis illegal. Oh, sorry. I forgot a major one. Police departments. Seizures, both of drugs, but also of cash associated with the dealing of cannabis, etc. That's also another big aspect of this. Police departments, local police departments receiving significant monies as a result of cannabis not being recreationally legal or even decriminalized at all. So on the one hand, that's why Big Pharma would oppose cannabis legalization. But at the same time, it seems Big Pharma realizes the writing is sort of on the wall. And Big Pharma has also been pursuing patents related to cannabis. So it's like they don't like it until they take over the business and can monetize it, at which point they really like it. None of this should surprise us. And if you've been following the political discussion around cannabis for any period of time or for more than a decade, as we have on the show, you would understand the incongruency. And we could really call it a double standard or hypocrisy that exists compared to so many different things. When you look at the Schedule I federal designation of cannabis, up there with the most damaging and addicting substances of no medicinal value. Hold on a second. We know. I mean, the studies, Big Pharma concedes that legal cannabis is a threat to their profits because it is of medicinal value without calling it a panacea, of course. You know that the Schedule I designation doesn't make any sense. And we've talked about all of these aspects before. So here is another one. And I still on this, you know, there was a period I remember early in the show's history where we started to see gay marriage legalization in one state, in another state, in a third state, in a fourth state. And at the time, I remember conversations with the team and with guests. There was a certain feeling of inevitability that it's hard to imagine 10 years down the line that gay couples, lesbian couples wouldn't be able to get married anywhere in the United States. And indeed, ultimately, it happened. I have a similar feeling of inevitability to some degree when it comes to cannabis. I don't know how soon we're going to see recreational legalization nationally. I don't know about that. But there's a sense of inevitability that we are heading in the direction at least of federal decriminalization. I don't know when it will come, but there's that same sort of sense that I have. If you disagree, let me know. I'd be interested in hearing from you. We have to talk about books. I like books. I like reading. And I say more books, the better, as a general rule. Doesn't mean every book is appropriate for every setting or every situation. Okay, we've talked about that before. But the real question I have is, according to these right wingers, is banning books good or bad? And you might be saying, well, David, no, it's obviously good or it's obviously bad. But it's really not so clear because we see both perspectives from this modern American book burning contingent that exists in the right. As I talked to you about not that long ago, book ban efforts have hit their highest levels in at least 20 years. And it's the right, not the left, that's doing this. We looked at this article, must have been, when is this article even from? About a month ago. We did the story a couple weeks ago, three weeks ago or so, that book ban efforts led by the American right wing are at their highest level in 20 years. Now, what we mean by book bans differs in different situations. In some cases, what we're talking about is a movement by the right to ban a book from being used in school. Sometimes it's novels, sometimes it's certain history books, etc. They're not necessarily calling for the books to not be published or for the books to be against the law, but they certainly want to cancel a teacher's ability to say, here's a book that I want to teach from. They don't want to give teachers that opportunity. In other cases, it's confusion about what it even means, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But we know that the efforts to ban books are at multi-decade highs led by the American right wing. So they must be in favor of the book bans, right? Well, apparently not, because remember the Dr. Seuss situation. This was now about a year ago. Well, it's actually hard to believe it's been a year, but it has been a year, where the publisher of Dr. Seuss books said, hey, you know what? Some of these books, this is our review. We're a private business. We can make the decisions that are right for us. We believe that some of these Dr. Seuss books. They have elements that are not really sensitive to modern cultural sensitivities. We're a private business, we're a publisher, and we think it's not good for business to keep publishing some of these. So we're not going to keep printing more copies. We're not burning the books. We're not saying the books should be against the law. We're not saying people can't read them. We just think continuing to print these particular books is no longer in line with what's best for us. And the right went crazy saying, oh my God, the left is banning the books. They're canceling Dr. Seuss. It's terrible. Always allow the books everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. Oh, okay. So they're against, I guess, limitations on books. Except now, as we talked about yesterday, and as we've been talking about for several months, they seem fine banning books when it's books that they don't like. When it's history books that tell the real story, as far as we know at this time, of slavery, of racial discrimination, of all sorts of different aspects of history, all of a sudden, the very same right wingers who were saying they're canceling Dr. Seuss, they say, we got to get these books the hell out of here. We now are learning about this new effort in Florida to reject math textbooks because they contain so-called critical race theory. Although Ron DeSantis and other Floridians have not been able to provide a single substantive example of where such critical race theory exists. So I guess the question of, is banning books good or bad? The answer is, well, I guess it depends on their mood. I guess it depends on which books. I guess it depends on who's doing it and why. And it's a very similar phenomenon with protests. If you're protesting police brutality, if you're protesting in favor of Black Lives Matter, if you're protesting in defense of George Floyd, well, then these protests are dangerous to law enforcement and we've got to back the blue and they're all violent and looting and all these different things. But if you're protesting against Joe Biden being the president and getting sworn in because he was elected on January 6th, well, then you're doing the right thing and you're being treated very unfairly by everybody. And what about back the blue because they beat up some cops? Oh, no, no, no. We don't care about that all of a sudden because they were protesting against the certification of the election. Oh, so I guess it's not really so simple. And the principle here is the one I've been telling you about now for years, which is they don't even really care about their own stated principles. They stake out apparent principles to justify the end results that they already want. If their principles all of a sudden would point to actually Black Lives Matter can protest, actually you shouldn't ban these books, then they change their principles because their principles are no longer convenient to their pre-existing end goals. And this is the theme we've been following for years at this point in time. I don't think this is going to stop anytime soon. And in particular, because they don't really want to engage on what should climate policy be? What should policy be on renewable sources of energy? What should the top tax rate be? They can only engage completely superficially. Taxes are bad. Green New Deal is bad. Because they are unwilling or unable to engage substantively on those issues, they're going to keep pushing this stuff and it works. I don't want to be a broken record, but part of why Glenn Youngkin won the Virginia gubernatorial race is because this stuff works. I will ban teaching of critical race theory. Who's teaching it? Well, it doesn't matter. I will ban it. Wow, I'm going to vote for this guy. This stuff works. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman. The David Pakman Show is funded by you. We really depend on you to produce this show. We have a membership program at joinpakman.com. We do an extra show every day for the people that sign up there. We've got this show you're listening to or watching now, but then we do another show for our members. We also offer commercial-free audio and video streams of the show every day, and we offer them up to 6 hours before the show is released to everybody else. So there's some great perks to membership. I would really love it if you signed up at joinpakman.com. And you can use the coupon code WOW22 to sign up at a discount. I don't care at what price level you get involved. If you want to do the big boy, the level 4 yearly membership, we welcome that. If you want to get a monthly membership with a discount code for under $2 a month, we welcome it. We welcome all levels of support. The point here is How many people can we get involved? That's the most important thing. And you can sign up at joinpacman.com. All right. This is a wild story that some people are actually finding themselves sort of triggered by. There's a MSNBC TV analyst named Malcolm Nance, and he's been around for a while now. A former intelligence guy, kind of a well-known in the space at this point in time. He has actually joined the fight in Ukraine. He is fighting in Ukraine, at least to some extent, against the Russian invasion. And this is fascinating. And without becoming sort of like a war porn advocate, this is someone putting their sort of money or their time, at least, where their mouth is. There's a report from the Denver Gazette. MSNBC analyst Malcolm Nance reveals he joined the fight in Ukraine. Malcolm Nance, an author and former military intelligence analyst, appeared for an interview Monday with MSNBC host Joy Reid, who said he was at a secure location. Nance was dressed in military garb and holding a rifle, said he joined Ukraine's Foreign Legion about a month ago to fend off what he called Russia's war of extermination. I have a little bit of that interview. Let's check it out. And you will notice if you're watching, Malcolm Nance is wearing, I don't want to use the wrong term. I guess we'll just call it military garb. And he's holding a weapon as well.
Joining me now from a secure location in Western Ukraine is Malcolm Nance, executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project. He is fighting with the International Legion of Territorial Defense of Ukraine. And Malcolm, we just watched that video of you, and Ali Aruzi was attempting to interview you for us to get more information on what you're doing. We saw those cruise missiles fly overhead. So explain to us why you are there and what you are doing.
Well, as you know, I spent quite a bit of time here in the pre-war period. And when the invasion happened, I had friends who were in Donetsk, who were in the Ukrainian army, who were writing to us and telling us, we're not going to survive tonight. We've been hit 500 times. You know, these are graduates of Defense Language Institute. These are my friends. And, you know, as the more I saw of the war going on, the more I thought, I'm done talking. All right. It's time to take action here. So about a month ago, I joined the International Legion here in Ukraine. And I am here to help this country fight, you know, what essentially is a war extermination. This is an existential war. And Russia has bought it to these people, and they are mass murdering civilians. And there are people here like me who are here to do something about it.
So there's some on the left who have reacted to this by saying, oh, God, the glorification of Malcolm Nance doing this is war porn. It's glorifying violence. It's pro-war to say what a great thing that Malcolm Nance is doing. I don't see it that way. Nance is 61. He could just stay with his cushy MSNBC gig, and I'm guessing he does consulting and speaking and all these different things. He is at least theoretically, I mean, listen, you know, if you come back and you tell me Nance isn't really exposed to any danger, this is all a setup. He put on a uniform and he's there, but he's in like the part of the country where nothing's going on. Okay, I mean, like, listen, there's no evidence of that, but I'm sure someone would make that claim. But at least in theory, he is, he's there and he's putting himself in at risk. And he believes that this is a war of aggression by Russia against Ukraine, that Ukraine is fighting a defensive war. And along those lines, if you are in a position to have to defend your country, and by proxy, that's what Malcolm Nance is doing, you're not pro-war because you say, wow, he's actually in the real world doing the thing that many of us just sit in front of microphones and say, this is the side that I'm on, for lack of a better term. So seeing this and saying that, the other aspect to this is there's a big, I don't want to call it big, there's a loud movement on the online left, which is very just black and white antagonistic against any government or intelligence agency. And they haven't liked Malcolm Nance for a long time. They say this guy is the epitome of the, sometimes they'll even use the term deep state, or of the establishment intel that got Iraq wrong, and they got this wrong, and they got that wrong. And so they see this as the sort of the worst meshing of American intelligence and corporate media and pro-war Democrats, or whatever you want to say. I really just don't see it that way. I am as anti-war as anybody else. this is a defensive war for Ukraine, and he is at least to some degree putting his money where his mouth is. It's not a glorification of war like a war movie. I just don't see it that way. If you disagree and you think that is what this Malcolm Nance thing is, then I want to hear from you. We've been extensively covering the growing civil war within the Republican Party. The battle lines are not super clear, but to some degree, at least at the very top level, the battle lines are pro-Trump and anti-Trump Republicans. And one really interesting figure in that is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And he's interesting because it's not exactly clear which side he's on. And what I mean by that is early in the pandemic, when the failed former president Donald Trump was still the actively failing president Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis and Trump were very buddy buddy. Early in the pandemic, DeSantis refused to close and or very quickly opened major events, sporting events, all sorts of different things. Trump pointed to DeSantis as a guy doing the right thing, and they were very buddy buddy. Over time, it started to become clear that there was at least some appetite from within the Republican Party for an alternative to Trump. And while the alternative that they seem to be seeking is not, you know, Mitt Romney, it's Ron DeSantis to some degree. Ron DeSantis has increasingly been thought of as an alternative to Trump. Now, it's weird because DeSantis is almost like Trump to the nth degree. DeSantis has a lot of the same terrible ideas of Trump, the same political instincts of Trump, but he's more competent and he's less cartoonish and he's probably more dangerous if he gets the opportunity to be president of the United States. But so kind of by default, there started to be this, well, will it be Trump 2024 or will it be DeSantis 2024? And this has really triggered Donald Trump to the point where we now have multiple reports we've told you about where Trump is reportedly furious that, for example, when DeSantis is asked, hey, will you run in 2024? DeSantis doesn't go, oh, absolutely not. It's Trump's for the taking. DeSantis hasn't said that. And there are numerous reports that Trump and people around him are upset about that. This brings us to this past weekend at Mar-a-Lago. And at Mar-a-Lago, Roger Stone, who was a guest on this program and was ultimately convicted and then pardoned, and he's a friend of Trump. OK, whatever. Roger Stone was filmed at Mar-a-Lago and he goes up to Trump and he says, Ron DeSantis is a piece of S. And that video was initially kind of cut so you don't really see what Trump's reaction is. Now the fuller video has been released. I'm going to play it for you. Now, of course, if you're listening, you're not going to know what Trump does. But the big deal that's being made is Trump nods when Roger Stone tells him Ron DeSantis is a piece of S. Let's take a look at the video. Let's take a listen to the video.
Have a good time tonight. Have a good time. Roger, my man, I didn't
even see. How could I not see my Lord? God bless you. Okay. So, listen, this is not like the big smoking gun that Trump has declared, you know, open season on Ron DeSantis or anything like it. There's also, we can't ignore that there's really strange kind of like Godfather vibes at the start of the first Godfather movie. Incredible movie. By the way, when I mention the Godfather, people email saying I'm glorifying violence because it's a violent film. No, it's just a great film. The scene at the wedding where everybody is kind of making their pilgrimages and saying, hello, thank you, Godfather. I have a favor. I need this. I need that. Oh, you're so great. There's a similar vibe to it that's developed at Mar-a-Lago with people coming and making their pilgrimages to Trump. But putting that aside, there is no question that Donald Trump is now hostile to Ron DeSantis. And it's increasingly clear that voters are aware that there is an alternative to Donald Trump. So we've looked at these numbers before and they continue to improve slightly in Ron DeSantis's favor. If you go to predictit.org, where you can bet on who will be, you can bet on almost anything. They'll take your action. But one of the things is you can bet on who will be the 2024 Republican nominee. Last time we looked at this, it was 39-29. 39% believed it would be Trump. And 29% believed it would be DeSantis. That was the closest it had been since the start of, you know, of the discussion of 2024. it is now tightened up a little bit more, where now it is 38-30. This is based on money betting. These aren't polls. But if you look at how people are betting, 38% now believe Trump will be the nominee and 30% believe it will be Ron DeSantis. There is no way Trump's not aware of these numbers. And DeSantis is quickly gaining ground on Donald Trump. This is the tightest that it's been. Now, if you look at actual polling, the most recent polling I found is from a couple months ago, actually almost 3 months ago. And there you had Trump at 57%. This was a Harvard Caps Harris poll. It had 3 months ago, Trump was at 57% among Republicans, and DeSantis and Pence each had 12. Now, that's 3 months ago. The numbers may well have tightened since then. But there is, let me put it a different way. It is not a foregone conclusion that if there is a contested 24 primary and Trump runs and DeSantis runs, that Trump runs away with it. There, DeSantis has growing support, and increasingly people believe he has a real shot. And that's the first step in having a shot. People believing you have a shot, it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So expect that it will get delightfully ugly if both Trump and DeSantis keep pointing towards, I may indeed run. Let me know your thoughts. We'll have the clip of Roger Stone and Trump at Mar-a-Lago on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Let's talk a little bit about radical Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, really the worst of the worst of American politics. If you imagine for a second, oh, let's say we were sending some elected officials to, you know, pick a country, wherever, Ireland, to represent the best of the United States House and Senate. Marjorie Taylor Greene is basically the most humiliating person you could send, along with a couple others, Madison Cawthorn, Louie Gohmert, Lauren Boebert, Matt Gaetz, these types of people. OK, so she's facing some problems. The first problem is that a judge has ruled that the effort to remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from her reelection ballot in November, upcoming now in a few months, can go forward. Now, the judge hasn't said she's off the ballot. The judge has said the effort can, in principle, go forward. This is absolutely fascinating. And this is going to be a legal fight. So let me explain what's going on, or we're going to look at the New York Times report from this morning. A federal judge cleared the way for a group of Georgia voters to move forward with legal efforts seeking to disqualify Greene from running for reelection. Why? Well, citing her role in the Trump riots. The disqualification effort is based on a constitutional provision adopted after the Civil War that barred members of the Confederacy from holding office. It mirrors several other cases involving Republican members of Congress whose roles leading up to and during the Trump riots have drawn criticism. The judge was appointed to the District Court for the Northern District of Georgia by President Barack Obama and denied Marjorie Taylor Greene's request for a preliminary injunction and temporary restraining order. In the 73-page ruling, Judge Tottenberg wrote that Greene had failed to meet the burden of persuasion in her request for injunctive relief. This case involves a whirlpool of colliding constitutional interests of public import, the novelty of the factual and historical posture, especially assessed in the context of a preliminary injunction motion, has made resolution of the complex legal issues particularly demanding. The argument that Greene made is there's no way to resolve this fully before the primary on May 24th. And absentee ballots are going to start being mailed in on April 25th. So there's no way to fully adjudicate this in time. And the argument from the judge here is Greene is arguing sort of like procedure, like the primary is really soon and there's no way to decide this now. The judge determined Greene hasn't shown that it's likely she would succeed on the merits. So she went, but Marjorie Taylor Greene went on Tucker Carlson's show last night, and she's flipping out. Listen to what she had to say.
I have to protect myself. I have to go to court on Friday and actually be questioned about something I've never been charged with and something I was completely against. And so this is how far it's going. These leftists, these progressives who would rather want, they'd rather have the judge or bureaucrats making decisions instead of voters. They want to hand that over to them and not let the people in my district to even have the right to vote for me. But no, the Republican Party.
Now, that's a very dishonest argument, because this is sort of like saying, hey, you know, there's rules about who can be in the House and Senate. And for example, if a member of the House were convicted of a crime and then forced to resign, anybody could get up there and say, you know what? The right of the people to just decide, given that this individual was convicted of a crime, do we still want them representing us or not? That's being denied to them. Right. But these are the rules. These are the rules. And the law is you can move to have someone taken off of a ballot if you can prove that they did certain things. That's all. It's very naive or cynical or just dishonest to say, oh, the people aren't being allowed to just voice their opinion. Well, there are times where we say you can't be on the ballot.
To fight harder, Tucker. You know, there's something that I have learned, and I think this is really important. You know, if you can challenge any representative's candidacy or elected office holder, then I bet you we could round up some Republican voters who didn't like Kamala Harris.
By the way, still can't pronounce Kamala's name.
Funding criminal rioters out of jail,
exactly.
Or Ilhan Omar or Cori Bush or Maxine Waters.
Now, what do those four women have in common? Hold on a second. Kamala Harris, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, Maxine Waters. There's something similar about them, right? I'm trying to remember. Why is she mentioning those four?
Citing riots. You know, I think there's another way to play this game.
Now, of course, this is also absurd what she says, because this is exactly what they did to Joe Biden's win. She said, you can't just have people challenge whatever, anybody's position. But Joe Biden won. And that's exactly what all of you guys did. You were like, no, he didn't win. He doesn't get to be there. There was no evidence for it. There was no legal basis. There was no factual basis. There was no empirical basis. So this is actually a very interesting legal case. If this were to work against Marjorie Taylor Greene to keep her off the ballot, you in theory could use it against other pro-insurrection, pro-riot politicians. And I'm sure that if this goes against Marjorie Taylor Greene, she will try to appeal. And maybe it would get all the way up to the Supreme Court, because they're actually, I don't want to pretend that the legal issue is cut and dry. I read a bunch of opinions this morning, and this comes down to the 14th Amendment. So there is a constitutional issue as to whether you really could keep her off the ballot in this way. There's a mechanism to request it. And if it were successful, there would be a question as to whether it's constitutional. But that doesn't matter. It's a process that is going through, and her disdain for having to participate in a legal process, aside from what your opinion is of what the outcome should be, is the exact type of entitlement that we've seen from these people for so very long. But this isn't the only problem that Marjorie Taylor Greene is having. Let's go to the next one. Marjorie Taylor Greene is in a very safe Republican district in Georgia as a radical Trumpist member of the House of Representatives. But for the first time, she spent more money than she raised, and her Democratic challenger raised more money than she did. Now, I don't want to give anybody false hope, because she is in a very red district, but this is not particularly good news for her. Democratic challenger outraises Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia. You really love to see this. Democrat Marcus Flowers outraised Greene in the first 3 months of 2022, according to his latest federal filings. Flowers, an Army veteran and former military contractor, pulled in more than $2.4 million in the first quarter of 2022, dwarfing, says The Hill, the fundraising hall of Greene, who raised under $1.1 million in the exact same time span. Now, importantly, not only is it a very safe Republican district, Flowers is behind Greene in cash on hand. The latest filings with the FEC show Greene has $3 million in the bank, Flowers has $1.9 million, and overall, Greene has raised about $8.4 million for her reelection. Flowers is behind, but not super far, at $7.1 million for his campaign so far. unseating Green is likely to be an uphill battle for any Democrat. That is absolutely true. But this may be a sign that there's an appetite for rejecting radical, extremist, cartoonish, pathetic, pond scum Trumpism, which is what Marjorie Taylor Greene represents. Yahoo News reporting, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's campaign committee goes into the red for the first time, clocking up a fundraising deficit totaling $314,000. Marjorie Taylor Greene's campaign committee reported its first net loss since she was elected. It spent $1.38 million in the first quarter of 2022 and banked $1.06 million in donations. The 1.06 was rounded to 1.1 in the previous article. The spending included $140,000 for her security and a retainer fee to Trump lawyer John Eastman. That's that wacky guy who's like, yeah, Mike Pence just overturned the entire thing. So again, the district is, depending on where you look, 30 points in favor of a Republican. It might only be 20. It might be 40. It depends where you look. But it is a really, really heavy Republican district. I don't know how Flowers wins, but this could be a good sign. And it's also important to understand that the incumbent effect is very real. And so even with the same fundraising, you would probably expect Green to win because the incumbency effect is very real. But that's also what makes the fundraising numbers even more notable. For a non-incumbent in such a red district to be equally or even outraising the incumbent Republican says a lot. Now, of course, a lot of that money is coming from out of the district. It's not a big shock that there are people outside of that Georgia district who would love to see Marjorie Taylor Greene removed because she's such a lunatic. And just holding the seat gives her an advantage. And this is not likely the district. This is not likely to be a bellwether district in November. There are others that are more likely to be bellwether districts. We're going to talk about them. But if we want to find something good here, it's that this is a sort of celebrity Republican congresswoman in a very red seat, and she lost net money, spent more than she took in the first quarter of 2022. And her opponent, who is not particularly well known, at least wasn't before this election started, is able to keep up in fundraising. It's a great thing. It would be great to knock her out. I'm not counting him out, but we just have to be realistic. It's an insanely Republican skewed district. We'll take a quick break and be back after this with much more for you. Yesterday, I came to you with the news that Alex Jones' InfoWars website has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. And I said, hey, listen, we've got to be careful with this because it seems that it is obviously a way to keep and hide money from being subject to settlements because the guy is being sued to high heaven and it's not going well. But it's still interesting. He immediately after the bankruptcy went public announced an emergency blowout. And I'm not talking about a diaper blowout caused by all those weird supplements that he takes. I'm talking about an emergency blowout sale of these kooky products that he has on his website. So wasting absolutely no time whatsoever. Here is Alex Jones' big announcement. Listen, if you've not gotten drinkable silver, this would be a great opportunity to do it.
You want us to be able to stay on air and be able to move forward in the future. I need you.
We don't really want that. That's the thing.
Now, to not wait and to go to InfoWarsStore.com, especially those of you that have never bought a book, never bought a film, never bought a T-shirt, never got a supplement.
Imagine buying a film from Alex Jones. That is something, huh?
Never got an air filtration, water filtration, shortwave radio, thousands of great items, books, you name it, at InfoWarsStore.com. Get your Living Defense. Get your Knockout. It's back in stock. Body's Ultimate Turmeric Formula, Lung Cleanse.
The Lung Cleanse. There's a product I would buy. I actually was thinking to myself, what could possibly be going on in someone's life where you go to Alex Jones' store to get a lung cleanser? I mean, like, what? If you fall for that, you could fall for anything.
They're all there at InfoWarsStore.com. And it's just that simple. There's also a button up on the top of the shopping cart that says support. and it says become a sponsor, and you just click there and you can give a monthly donation or just give a one-time donation, and then we actually get 95% of that money,
right,
instead of just, you know, 30 or 40%, 50% with the sale of the product. So this is do or die time. If you want to keep us on air through the you know, these attacks of the system and the system pulling out all the stops to
You know, the crazy thing is, like, the I've never met a genuine fan of Alex Jones. I've met people who watch his content because it's so crazy and they're curious, like we do, right? I mean, we kind of keep an eye on what all of these extremists do. I have never met someone who seriously watches Alex Jones.
How to silence us, then this is the time. They are trying to silence you. They're trying to take down the leading voice of resistance.
If Alex Jones is the leading voice of resistance, we're really in trouble. Our good friend Farron Cousins had a good tweet with similar thoughts to mine from yesterday about the entire bankruptcy thing. Farron tweeted, quote, "A lot of people celebrating Alex Jones filing for bankruptcy, but that move just screws over the victims and allows him to shield money from them that they would otherwise be able to go after. This move protects him and his money and is not a good thing." Farron going on to say the filing also lets him restructure his business holdings in order to keep operating, so the hatred and conspiracies aren't going away. So I don't trust the entire bankruptcy thing any further than I'd be able to throw Alex Jones. I don't. It stinks to high heaven, like I said yesterday. And there are lots of people celebrating it. And I mean, listen, you can be for speech, but for the failure of certain types of speech, right? I mean, this is like an age old battle and debate. For example, I used to interview these people from the Westboro Baptist Church, and they were the ones who would show up at soldiers' funerals with signs that would say, you know, God hates these people and those people. You know, the people. I could recognize that they have a right to speak. Now, you know, there are different laws around protesting at funerals and things like that. But let's generally just say I recognize that people have a right to express their opinion. But at the same time, I can be thrilled if their opinion is so unsavory that they sort of like go out of business. And that's kind of what's happened with the Westboro Baptist Church. I'm not saying that they're bankrupt, but they have become so out of favor where even the small amount of interest that there was in their message has evaporated. And they're nowhere now. I think that that's fantastic. I'm not against free speech because their speech is unpopular. And similarly, there is absolutely no question whatsoever that Alex Jones is allowed to have a show. The government can't legally. I mean, they shouldn't be censoring him. Platforms can decide based on their terms of service whether what Alex Jones does is or isn't allowed. But it's okay to be happy if Alex Jones' particular speech is so distasteful that it becomes financially inviable, not viable. That's a great thing. I'm happy about that. And it's not about, oh, David, do you wish that? Yeah, my Alex Jones impression, right?
Globalist, internationalist, Trotskyite socialists, unlike Obama, Trudeau, Macron, and the rest of these Zio beasts.
Yeah, okay. I think it's a great thing if his speech is considered so disgusting that he can't make money off of it. Call me crazy. I think that that's a good thing. There's a guy named Charles Herbster. He's running for state Senate. And he's running for Senate. Well, what is he running for? We're going to figure it out in a second. He has been accused of groping more than six women. And he has been very strongly endorsed by Donald Trump. Vanity Fair piece by Bess Levin. Charles Herbster insists he's the victim of a smear campaign trying to destroy him with lies. Bess Levin writes, Donald Trump isn't great at a lot of stuff, but one thing he absolutely excels at is endorsing horrible people for office. Since 2016, a who's who of Trump-backed candidates has included Roy, reportedly banned from the mall more, Lauren, I'll carry my Glock to Congress, Boebert, Herschel, if evolution is real, why do apes still exist, Walker? Ron, don't say gay, DeSantis. Mehmet, have some snake oil, Oz. Matt, human trafficking is fine, Gates. And Mary, Hitler actually had a good idea, Miller. In October, a guy running for, oh, it's Nebraska governor, named Charles Herbster, got himself added to the list. He has a habit of allegedly groping women. The Nebraska Examiner reported Thursday 8 women say Herbster groped them, writing that 6 women said he touched them inappropriately when they were saying hello or goodbye or when posing for a photograph by his side. A 7th accused the candidate of cornering her in private and forcibly kissing her. All of the women told the outlet they were intentionally grabbed, not inadvertently grazed. In one particularly gross incident, Republican State Senator Julie Slema said that Herbster, in the middle of a crowded room at an event for the Douglas County Republican Party, reached up her skirt and touched her inappropriately without her consent. These are allegations, folks, remember. Another person who attended the event confirmed they saw Herbster reach up Slema's skirt and claimed that he also groped another woman's butt at the same event, The Nebraska Examiner piece is quite disturbing. Republican state senator and 7 other women say Charles Herbster groped them. He denies the allegations. Now, remember that even if you think Trump as a business person is no good, you don't like Trump's foreign policy, you don't like Trump's views on immigration or whatever, his continued claim to fame, and one often cited by his strongest supporters, is he makes good choices with hiring. He hires the right people. He hires the best people. And he continues to endorse people accused of or proven to have said horrible things. I encourage you to check out the Nebraska Examiner article by Aaron Sanderford. It's very extensive. It's very detailed, etc. Now, the biggest frustration I think that many of us are having at this point is that these types of allegations don't matter if the electorate that supports you doesn't care about them or only cares about them when they are allegations against Democrats. And that's basically what we have seen. I mean, at this point, I'm curious to hear from people in the audience. Do allegations like this matter at all anymore? Trump was accused. You know, even the number is a hard number to say. Trump was accused very specifically of what we would call sexual assault type behaviors by around a dozen women. But then subsequently, we learned about allegations of a more kind of broader scope from more than 40 women. And he talked about grab them by the you know what and all these you just do it and all these different things. And he was elected president in 2016. He was really elected. And we could say, well, part of it was Hillary wasn't a great candidate and you know, these different things. But the side that claims to be about family values and all these things has not cared about it when it's Trump and they excuse it away. Well, Hillary's worse, or what am I going to do? Stay home, or those are lies. It's fake news, all these different things. So does it even matter when their side is accused of this stuff? And we've also talked before about how sometimes, to show how much not like them we are, the left sometimes goes overboard. I think the greatest example is the Al Franken situation. Al Franken, you know, he took a distasteful picture and it was inappropriate and it was wrong and he apologized and all these different things. But immediately, many prominent Democrats said Al Franken must resign. And he did. And Democrats lost what was a good senator. And I'm not defending what Al Franken did, but I'm pointing out the scale of what he did is nothing compared to what many of these Republicans have been accused of or have been proven to have done. And it may almost be a fault of the left that it so quickly goes to, we're not going to be like them. We're going to clean house the same way they should be cleaning house. Yeah, but they're never going to do it. And I don't know what the exact right balance is to find, but they don't seem to care about any of this stuff. And so there's a real question as to how the left should manage and react to it. Let me know your thoughts. I don't know what the right strategy is. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 219-2-DAVID-P. So yesterday, a guy from Alabama who said he doesn't know a lot of Jews, he called in and he wanted me to explain Yiddish words to him. And the questions were, what is Schmeckle
and what's the difference between Schmeckel and Shekel. Now, the Eggman called in. The Eggman is a Jewish man. And the Eggman says it's wrong that asking me Jewish questions is like asking a black woman to touch her hair. I don't know if this analogy is exactly right, but let's listen to what the Eggman had to say.
Hey, Dave. The caller on today's show was a schmuck. Without using any Yiddish words, and I'm just kidding, I really can't stand when people say to me, hey, man, did Jews do this? Hey, did Jews believe this? That's like going up to a black woman and saying, hey, can I touch your hair? I mean, I get it. Like when I was in prison, I'd meet guys from the South that would say, you're a Jew? Where are your horns? Okay, I get that. But it's not 25 years ago, and we have the internet and modern times now. So I find it highly insulting, and I go back to my original comment that caller was a schmuck for asking you to speak for the Jewish language, for the Hebrew language, or the Yiddish language. Shalom, brother.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with the Eggman. I mean, like, let's just think it through. Would it be crazy to think, let's imagine like a really spit. What is a schmeckle is not exactly mainstream. It's not like, hey, do Jews believe in the New Testament? And it's like, no. Okay. So it's schmeckles. It's pretty niche. Let's say there was a discussion as to which African countries were the main sources of slaves brought to the United States. And let's say in a conversation, someone said, oh, were there a lot of American slaves that came from the Central African Republic, right? That's a really specific question. I don't know the answer to that. Would it be wrong to wonder if a black person in the group might be more informed about that than I am? I don't know. I guess I'm not sure. I don't think the Eggman is right that asking me about Yiddish words is the same as asking to touch a black woman's hair. That there just seems to be absolutely no comparison there. But is it reasonable to wonder whether, based on an individual's identity, you might know more about a particular thing? I mean, if you knew someone was a parent, I think it would be reasonable to go to them with parenting questions over someone who's not a parent. If you knew someone was tall, I don't think it's unreasonable to go to them with questions about the day to day of living while being tall. I don't know. I don't know that this is that crazy. I think the real critique is, you know, about Google, right? Like if I ever wonder about these questions, you just Google it. I don't know that you need to leave me a voicemail, wait 2 weeks for me to get to that voicemail and then give you an answer. But it is content. So I don't know. Let me know your thoughts. We have an explosive bonus show today. There's not an emergency blowout the way that Alex Jones described earlier on the show, but we have a very explosive bonus show today. A Trump-appointed judge has said the CDC exceeded its jurisdiction with the mask mandate on planes, and the judge ended the mask mandate on planes. Yesterday, pilots came out during flights and announced to their passengers, the mask mandate is over. They unmasked, and passengers cheered and unmasked, and immunocompromised people on those flights were horrified. We're going to talk about it. Also, J.D. Vance, who I at one point thought, hey, this is kind of like a reasonable Republican. I was wrong. J.D. Vance, who is running for the Ohio Senate seat, has been endorsed by failed former President Donald Trump. We will talk about J.D. Vance. And thirdly, Elizabeth Warren is now targeting Nancy Pelosi in a bid to avoid midterm losses for Democrats in November. What? I will explain all of it to you on today's bonus show. You can access the bonus show instantly by becoming a member at joinpacman.com. Absolute last thing. It is finally that day. It's almost like Christmas morning for our Christian viewers, or the fourth day of Hanukkah for our Jewish viewers. I always got the best gifts on the fourth day. That's why I was always excited about day four. It is the day of the David Pakman Show Town Hall. The Town Hall will be live today, Tuesday, April 19, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. We will be streaming live on the Pakman Live YouTube channel. And if you'd like to call in, you can do so through our Discord, davidpakman.com/Discord. If you're a member, we will have a priority line for you, which is very exciting and just another reason to get yourself that membership at joinpacman.com. I will see everybody on the bonus show today, on the town hall tonight, or otherwise, sadly, tomorrow.
Here's a song all about my deep devotion and love to the banjo. Yeah, there's a lot of jokes about the banjo. Silver strings are really fun to play. I learned a lot of jokes about the banjo. I try to memorize a new one every day.